Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Mike Monaco. Mike is a criminal defense lawyer or a trial lawyer who does criminal defenses and maybe some civil work. But the key is that he is a courtroom trial lawyer who handles some of the most visible and well-known national cases for people and causes in the United States over many years. We're going to be talking with him about what is the role of a defense attorney in a high-profile case, and some other things that we need to toss about in our heads, talking about plea bargaining, for example, talking about visibility of cases and people and issues and what their importance is in the national life. So, Mike Monaco, who is a member of the firm of Monaco and Spivak in Chicago. With respect. Mike, how are you today?
Fine, John. How are you?
I'm absolutely fantastic. It's a great day.
It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, it is. Mike, where are you from originally?
Chicago.
What part of the city?
The far southeast side.
Oh, that's sounding good already. Are you
not
by,
far from Indiana, actually.
Are you by any chance a White Sox fan?
My brother was.
Oh.
Before he passed. But my father and I were Cub fans. And still are Cub fans.
No, that's too bad. All right. Well, we'll work on that. There's a pill for that, you know.
Yeah.
We can cure you.
My brother was a big Sox fan. He had in his basement, he had all kinds of Sox paraphernalia.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He's probably in heaven right now.
I hope so.
All right. So, Mike, where'd you go to school?
I went to high school at St. Ignatius in Chicago. I was the first kid from my parish to go there. And then I went to Georgetown University for college and Northwestern for law school.
Why did you get into law? What was that? What was the thing that drove you there?
Well, my father... was a very active fellow in public speaking, and was very often the master of ceremonies at veterans events. He lost his left arm in the Second World War and spent 2 years in an Army medical hospital and 1 year in a full body cast. And as he says, the only thing that kept him out of college was high school. But he was a very prominent public speaker and won the award 1 year from the President of the United States for doing the most to promote the hiring of the handicapped. And he was a wonderful fellow, and he would come to all my trials. But before that, when I was a kid, he would always talk about lawyers, and I think he always thought I'd become a lawyer, and I became a lawyer.
How about the rest of your family? How about your mom?
My mom was a lovely lady. She died in 2016. At the age of 102.
Huh?
Yeah, she was a lovely lady. So she was born in 1914 and was just a wonderful lady and worked her whole life and was terrific. I have two sons and two daughters. Two of my sons are lawyers. One does personal injury work in Chicago, and the other was with a big firm, and now he's with a private business.
Mm-hmm. Your dad was his primary work was to be speaker, or
his primary work was a veterans working at the veterans hospital in Chicago in human resources.
I see. Did you want to be a lawyer, or was it something?
I always thought I wanted to be a lawyer because
Why?
I thought it'd be a good practice, a good position, a good career to help people, and I like the idea of being a public speaker. I like the idea of speaking to juries.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of having you know, media attention. So it's all, I liked it all.
Mm-hmm. Where did you start after you you began to practice?
Well, I was a federal prosecutor when I graduated from law school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Northwestern Law School, then I became a federal prosecutor in Chicago from 73 to 77, and then I started my own practice in 1977, and I've had my own practice ever since.
One of the interesting things about the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Illinois, which is Chicago, is that, and I've had experience all over the country with U.S. attorneys' offices, as you have, but I did it from the inside, from the Department of Justice side, now in private practice. But one of the interesting things is there's basically three offices in the United States that are unique in their relationship to the community in which they're located. One is the District of Columbia, U.S. Attorney's Office there, because they handle all different kinds of crime as opposed to just, you know, white-collar, political corruption cases that you hear about, but they do the street crimes. The second office is the Southern District of New York, in that they have a tradition of being quite, they consider themselves the second Department of Justice, and the U.S. attorney there is the second attorney general in the United States. I think that's a bit of ego, more than a bit of ego. But the third one is the U.S. attorney's office in Chicago, and it's different than many, many of the offices around the country in that the people who go there and the people who come out are part of the warp and woof of Chicago and Illinois society and nationally, i.e., they are they leave the office maybe like you did after 4 years, but they're still part of this family that is a part of the city in Chicago, the law, the government, the society, the culture of the city of Chicago. You may have a different feeling, but I from both the inside and outside, would tell you that's my observation.
I think that's true about Chicago. I can't speak for D.C. or New York. I've tried cases in both places, but in Chicago, people who leave the office sort of consider it a fraternity or sorority, or mm-hmm. you know, because we every year we have a Christmas party with all the former assistants come. And it's a great place to have worked, and it's a great place to be from.
I had occasion to be the acting U.S. attorney for the prosecution of the El Rucan gang back in the early 90s. And at that time, I was offered help by the head of the FBI. And it's a long story, but he was very kind of nice to me, and he patted me on the head because I was a U.S. attorney from this. Where is it from? I said, well, Western Michigan. Now, where is that? And so I said, finally, after listening to this for a while, I said, you know, I went to law school about 200 feet from here.
Yeah.
And I said, by the way, have you ever been to the U.S. attorney's, former U.S. attorney's Christmas party? And all of a sudden, the patronizing goes away, and he says, what do you know about that? Yeah. What do you know about that?
Well, FBI agents are not invited to that.
But so the story was when he first became SAC, SAC, Special Agent in Charge, his ASAC assistant said to him, boss, you got to go to this party. You know, you got to go to this party. And he said, I don't go with any bloody U.S. attorneys or lawyers. I don't need that. He said, no, you better. So this SAC said to me, so I went in the door, I stuck my head in the door, and I said, oh, my God, everybody who's anybody in this city is in this party. And it's true.
That's a good group.
It's a good group. Yeah. And they have a love for that office in the sense that they may fight them. They may fight them tooth and nail in a case, but they want that office to succeed in their overall mission. I've seen that, heard that, talked to.
I think that's true. Mm. Although I'm not sure now with this particular attorney general. The past attorney general too, Sessions, and now this fellow Barr. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing in terms of the office as a, in terms of the office as a group, in terms of how you treat people and how they're perceived by the public, because I'm a little concerned about Mr. Barr, and as I was about Mr. Sessions, but we'll see. I assume we'll succeed. We'll pass this.
I will intervene and tell you that both Sessions and Barr are friends of mine.
Yeah, well.
And from different times.
Barr was a friend of several friends of mine.
Oh, yeah. He is.
He was. I'm not sure if he still is, but he was.
Well.
But now he's conducting himself in a way that seems very problematic.
Well, there is a case to be made for either way. I mean, I've heard friends of mine who are very unhappy with how the department is running, and also very happy. So I'm not down there, and I haven't seen Bill for a couple of years, so I have no personal axe to grind here, except that he is my friend, and I worked for him for 2 years. Now, moving on, though, this point that I made and you agree with is this office, this Northern District of Illinois is a powerhouse when it comes to understanding how law, honest government, and policies can work together one way or another for the good or the worse. And I remember when I was first getting out of law school, I had the opportunity to go into the U.S. Attorney's Office. And it was a very political thing. It was pure politics. If you got a if I came out of John Marshall, I was told that if I wanted to be an assistant U.S. attorney, I had a guy.
Was that under Hanrahan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that was probably true under Hanrahan.
Yeah. But then Bill
Bauer and Thompson.
Bill
changed.
Bauer came in, and Thompson. It's all changed.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And Bill Thompson has talked on the show a couple of times about that process that they went through, and they brought in you, and they brought in Dan Webb, Tony Valukas, and that crowd of people, and they were a powerful package. You were a powerful package in those days.
No, I think they did. We have to credit Bauer and Thompson for that, because they changed it from a political position to a meritorious position.
And now it is one of the most difficult places for a young attorney
to get into. Oh, I know. Thousands of applicants for one spot. So
yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Very tough.
Anyway, so you'd spent 4 years. What kind of cases did you deal with in those days?
All kinds of cases. Mail fraud, drugs. I had a terrorist case. Somebody hijacked an airplane. All kinds of cases.
Why the U.S. Attorney's Office as opposed to going right into private practice?
Well, like it is today, the U.S. Attorney's Office is a great spot to work, great place to learn how to try a case, great place to learn how to investigate a case. And it, is a great add to your resume.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a great spot to work.
But you went into private practice, and why was that?
I had always intended to do that. I thought I'm from Chicago. I thought I could make a living in Chicago. It's not easy doing that. I don't know if people do that now. It's hard to imagine now someone leaving the office and starting his own practice.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, I remember I had my first case. And I got a $5,000 fee, and that was enough to pay my rent for the year where I was in my small little office. Today, that's not the case. So
that would pay about a week.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But there is the lure of making a living. But there's what else got you out there? Why? I mean, you could have stayed there in the U.S. Attorney's Office as a career.
No, I couldn't.
Why not?
Back then, very few people did. Back then, it wasn't that way. I mean, you worked four or five years, and then you leave. And that's the way I think it should be. Because when we were there, we worked late.
Mm-hmm.
If you know the job is for 4 or 5 years, you're going to work late. You're going to spend all your time there. If you know that the job is a career for the rest of your life, you're leaving at 5 o'clock.
That's interesting.
You're not going to spend. You're not going to be there till 8 or 9 o'clock. I remember one time I was doing an appeal. I spent the night there at the U.S. Attorney's office all night,
mm-hmm.
working on the appeal to get it, make sure it got done by the next day. So I think that's the difference, and I do think it's a mistake for people to stay too long at the U.S. Attorney's office.
Why?
Because I think that's the point. The point is it becomes a career, not a special job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it should be special.
All right, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk more about how you got your start in private practice and your thoughts as you developed. I mean, your relationship with prosecutors and the public and the media are pretty important. So, this is John Smetanka, Ron, with respect, and we're talking to Mike Monaco of the firm of Monaco and Spivak. They are attorneys in Chicago, but they handle cases all over the country and some very high visibility cases. We will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Mike Monaco, who is a very well-known, nationally well-known attorney doing defense work in the United States courts and courts around the country. This is John Smetanka. So, Mike, you started off in private practice, and I'm sure you didn't start off by representing the President of the United States.
Well, you know, that's not exactly true.
Oh.
When I started the business, started my practice, the first 2 years of my practice, I got involved in some very high-profile cases. One was in Indiana, where a young man was working for the CIA and was arrested for selling secrets to the Russians involving the KH-11 spy satellite. And that was one case. The other case was a couple of Croatian fellows seized, at the time, was the West German consulate on Michigan Avenue when there were two Germanies, and held people hostage in order to get one of their friends in West Germany to be freed. In other words, in that case, Tito had put out a warrant for a fellow who was a political Croatian person, a person who was seeking the freedom from Croatia as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And Tito had a warrant for this fellow, and Germany arrested him. And that night in Chicago, the night that my client and another fellow seized the West German consulate, there happened to be in Chicago the brother of the fellow who was arrested in West Germany. And he was here with his lawyer, a German lawyer. And they heard what was happening and went to the West German consulate and spoke to my client and the other fellow and said to them, "Do not worry, my brother will not be sent to," at the time it was Yugoslavia. And he testified in court. He said, "I told them if I thought my brother was going to be sent back to Yugoslavia, I would have killed him." I mean, that's how strongly these people felt about Tito, how adverse they were to him. And in that case was an interesting case because they were caught inside the consulate, and they were acquitted of kidnapping. So that was a big case.
Yeah,
they were convicted of some lesser offense that was then thrown out. Mm-hmm. was wrongly brought, but that was a big case, and so that helped me. And I tried a couple of other Croatian cases around the country, and I won a big case in New York, in the Southern District of New York, in front of Constance Baker Motley, who was the former Chief Justice of the Southern District, and she was the first African American woman to become a federal judge. And there were 10 defendants in that case. The trial went on for 3 months. I lived in New York for 3 months. And that
was a trial.
That was a trial. My client was the only one on videotape. And he was on videotape buying guns and dynamite from an undercover ATF agent. And one thing happens in long cases. The jury gets to know you, gets to know your client.
Mm-hmm.
My client testified in that case. He testified that he was buying these things, but he wasn't buying them to use in
terrorism.
In terrorism cases, he was buying them to be sent back to Tito, back to fight the war in Yugoslavia. And they asked him, who are you sending these to? And he said, I will never tell you who I was sending them to. It was very dramatic cases. And then his wife testified. She was a fabulous witness. And he was acquitted. Of the 10 defendants, 4 were acquitted, and the other 6 got the maximum 40 years in jail.
Whoa.
So we walked out of the courtroom. My client had been in jail throughout the trial, for the 3 months of the trial and the 6 months before the trial. And I remember we walked out of the Southern District of New York. It was an amazing day, yeah.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
That's one of the things about trial work. You do not understand the ups and downs of emotions until you are in a trial and it's a part of your soul and you put your soul in front of that jury or that judge at the end of a case. And you wait for the verdict to come in. And the longest part of my life was the time from the time that the jury door opened until they all walked in and announced their verdict. That was the tension. And when you lose, God, that's painful. But when you win...
Yeah. Well, that jury was out about 7 days in New York. And I remember Constance Baker Motley required all of us, all 10 lawyers... to stay on the floor of the courtroom for those while the jury was out. So we all had to stay there, and we ended up playing poker, and I learned that the Croatian defendants did not like to fold, so that was helpful. They considered it unmanly to fold. But my client was in custody. He was not out. He was in custody. But it was it was an amazing victory, and he's gone on to a great life in Chicago. And now, his son became a lawyer.
Well, you mentioned an espionage case in northern Indiana.
Yeah, that was Campilis.
Yes.
That was a sad case.
Well, there, a friend of mine was also involved in that, Denny Colenda, who was somehow got involved in the Campilis case, either after or before you got into it or whatever, I'm not sure. But he is now a judge or retired judge up in Grand Rapids. But Denny was talked always about that case.
Was he a lawyer?
Yeah, he was a lawyer at the time. Oh. I don't know what he did.
I know Jim Richmond, who went on to be the U.S. Attorney in the Northern District of Indiana, was one of the prosecutors, and the other prosecutor was the U.S. Attorney at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a strong case, and my client was convicted, and unfortunately spent some time in jail. He just got out, so I'm happy. I mean, reaching out a couple of years ago, he got out, so I'm happy about that.
Well, you know, there's we're going to be leading now into the lure of the big public case, of the tough case, of the notorious case. And you said earlier that you liked that. You love that. Why?
I mean, I like to be involved in important matters, that these cases are important. And they're important to everybody, important to the system, important to this public, you know, most important to the defendant. And I like cases where the defendant has a lot at stake. Because that's what it's all about, helping somebody through their most difficult period of their lives.
Why do you do it? I mean, come on, seriously. We've had some really bad people in public life, in private life, business life, unions, spies, terrorists. Apparently, really bad. They're portrayed in the media when they're arrested as the lowest form of life. And then a guy like you walks in to represent them. And Why do you do it?
Well, you know, one thing you learn, not everybody's as bad as the government claims they are.
Really?
Yeah. And so you learn that there are, in both those cases I mentioned where there were acquittals, the jury learned about the defendant. I'll tell you, in the case involving the West German consulate, my client told me, because they wrapped up some batteries to make them look like bombs, and one of the things that was wrapped up is like a kitchen utensil, a kitchen item where you can keep sugar and flour and things in them, and they had it wrapped up with black tape and had batteries attached to it, so it looked like a bomb. And the government never opened it up. And he said to me during the trial, he says, his name is Bojo Calava. Bojo said, you know what's in the box? I said, no, what's in there? He says, tea bags. I say, why tea bags? He said, I wanted it to be a tea and tea bomb.
Oh, God, no.
So in the closing argument, I open it up and I take out the tea bags. And I tell the jury that.
Uh-huh.
And they loved my client. They understand that they liked them. But the government always claimed it was part of the... Because the witnesses who testified were not too terribly against our clients either. The government claimed that was part of the Stockholm syndrome.
Oh yeah,
that they were released, so therefore they felt some sort of good feelings towards mm-hmm. the people who were their captors, and maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know, but the jury ended up not being terribly against our client, and they acquitted him of the big cases, the big count against them.
One of the things that you do, I know this because I've seen you on television and I've seen you doing press conferences and whatnot, you are not afraid to deal with the media. In fact, I would look at you and say you love it.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think, well, there are two things. One, of course, there's a rule that says you cannot say anything that you think is intended to affect the jury prior to a trial. So you have certain restrictions, but you are entitled to defend your client. And if the government says something at a press conference, you're entitled to reply.
Mm-hmm.
And... So I have no fear in doing that. Now, I was just involved in a case involving a lot of publicity in Washington, Michael Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
I represented Mr. Cohen in front of the House Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first the House... Oversight Committee in front of Congressman Cummings, who was a really amazing fellow I'll tell you one thing about that, which I thought was interesting. Prior to our client, we were preparing our client to testify, and he testified, and I thought he was truthful, and I thought he did a good job of testifying, despite all of the attacks that the Republicans had. Literally, during his testimony, they put up a sign that said, liar, liar, pants on fire, in the House of Representatives, in the committee room. That was their... That's how they defended him. And as one of the Democratic congressmen said, Mr. Cohen, don't worry. They're not upset that you're lying. They're upset that you're telling the truth. And I thought that was a telling story.
Well, there's a great picture I saw of you behind Michael Cohen. You're literally right almost on top of his ear. As he's answering questions, and note was taken of that Mike Monaco is right there close to his client.
So that was funny too, because we went into that, we prepared him for that event thinking we were going to be next to him, Mr. Lanny Davis, who brought me in the case, and I would be on one side, I'd be on the other side, and you know, you remember Brendan Sullivan there when Oliver North testified, and he said, I'm not a potted plant,
right,
to the congressman at the time. So I was prepared to say that I'm not a potted plant. And then Congressman Cummings says, no, no one's going to sit next to him, he's going to testify on his own. And so he said, "What? We can't sit next to him?" No. I said, "Okay, well, we'll be behind him, I guess." So we sat behind him.
Yeah.
And that ended up being interesting.
There's a good example. Now, the Cohen case, he was testifying about his relationship with a client, Donald Trump.
Who became President of the United States.
President of the United States. And so there's not much more tension can be in the air from people not just in that room, but around the White House and other parts of the Department of Justice and so on. There can't be much more attention paid to when either Oliver North stands up and says, "Yeah, I lied to you. I absolutely lied to you, to the Congress, and I'd do it again," in his full Marine uniform. So that's that made a showman's statement. And you've got and Michael Cohen. But the interesting thing is the interrelationship here between you as the defense attorney, not just in this case, but other cases, where you become, I don't want to say manipulator, you become the projector of your client's persona to the rest of the world, where they're not going to get it from the U.S. attorney or the prosecutor or the judge. They're not there to help this judge. Pardon me, this client. So we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to talk about this role of full body defense against or for a client in high visibility cases. This is John Smetanka, Ryan With Respect, and we're talking to Mike Monaco, who is a member of the firm of Monaco and Spivak in Chicago, and they do high visibility cases of all kinds around the country and very successfully. And I'm still doing it today. We'll be talking about how do you deal with these folks who have gotten themselves into public positions or public office or whatever it is, and the world starts coming after them. As I say, this is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Michael Monaco, who is the attorney for, in this case we've been talking about, Michael Cohen, but many, many other high visibility defendants, interesting cases, very tense trials, I'm sure, but also things that go on in the background, in the preparation of a case, and in dealing with the public. So, this is John Smetanka. Mike, when we broke, we were talking about, and I talked about how you engage not just in the courtroom, you know, cross-examining or examining a witness, but you are, pardon me, you're doing it with a purpose. It's not just, I want to, I don't know what, make a show for myself. You're defending a guy or a gal. What goes through your mind when you take a high visibility case and you start to structure, see, or what am I going to do? What is my approach going to be?
So every criminal case, when you walk into a courtroom and the jury comes in after they're selected and the judge tells them this is a criminal case, in every case, they look at the defendant and they think, well, he must have done something to be sitting there. And you have to understand that. In a high-profile case, it's worse because they've heard about the case.
Mm-hmm.
And they assume he's done something horrible to be there because it's such a high-profile case. For example, during the Operation Greylord cases, there were a bunch of people got... And it was a very, very important investigation, Operation Greylord.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the government did an excellent job. And I had a defendant in that one of those cases was a lawyer, had a small private practice. He and his wife was not a lawyer, but helped him as a secretary and assistant. And everybody in that case had been convicted. Mm-hmm. And those, that investigation, all different kinds of cases, judges and lawyers. And this was the only case where a lawyer was acquitted.
Mm.
And it was interesting because again, like, it's very, very important for the jury to get a real understanding of who your client is and who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And to explain to the jury that he's, you know, it's that, yes, he's here, but you'll see why he's here. It's not because he did anything wrong. It's here for a because the government, someone is falsely accusing him. That's why he's here.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, a judge testified that my client gave him money, and that was a lie. And the jury found that it was a lie, and the jury acquitted my client.
Who's the judge?
Siemens at the time. And he was the only judge to testify that he took money from a client, took money from a defendant. Took money from a lawyer in the case. And anyway, it was a one interesting thing about that case. So, again, I call the wife of the defendant, and because she had done a lot of work. She had spent months going over all of the files that were in the government's possession from this particular courthouse in the south suburbs of Chicago. So she knew every case. And she knew that there are only like a half a dozen cases where this judge, particular judge, was the judge on a case involving her husband. So the first person I call when the government rests is the FBI agent sitting at the government's table. And I had not told him I was going to call him. So I called him and I said, now, my client's wife has been looking at all these files for months, hasn't she? Yes, she was. And you saw her there, didn't you? Yes, she was. And she was there every day that she said she was going to be there. She was there. Yes, she was. And isn't it true that there are only five cases involving this judge who testified against our client and our client? Isn't that true? I don't know. You don't know? You're the judge. You haven't examined them? Well, I don't remember. You know, so that was helpful. Then I called my client's wife, and she was a great witness.
Mm-hmm.
The jury loved her. And when my client testified, I said something to him that I say to most clients. It's not important that they believe you. It's more important that they learn who you are and learn to like you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will believe you. And sure enough, he testified, and they believed him, and he was acquitted. He was the only, and there were two judges on trial in that case. One judge was acquitted, one other judge was convicted in that case. But that was an important case.
Well, that case, we've had on this show, we've had a number of different witnesses, guests who talked about their work in that case. And one of them was one of the undercover judge
witnesses.
Witnesses, yeah. Wrote a book about Greylord. And I watched it as a U.S. attorney. I watched it from somewhat of a distance, but in our area in Michigan, we are still a Chicago media market in good sections of it, and so I would see more of it. And, of course, I knew Dan Webb and many of the guys and Tony Valukas and whatnot who were involved in those prosecutions. It's a great Dan Webb story. He was not in that particular case. He was dealing with the Tylenol case. Back when we first became U.S. attorneys together, and he was at a meeting with us at the advisory committee of U.S. attorneys down in D.C., and every media wanted to talk about this Tylenol, and that was back when we had four or five news sources, TV news sources. So everybody would be calling him out of our meeting, calling him out of our meeting, calling him out of our meeting, and finally, and Dan was ironically a shy guy when in that situation, and he apologized to the rest of the committee, and he said, geez, guys, I'm really sorry about this, but you know, they've got this poisoning, people are getting killed, and the TV wants to know about it, and I feel really badly about having to leave your meeting, but I got to do this. At which point, Mel McDonald, who's the U.S. attorney in Arizona, said, no, Dan, that's okay, no problem. My mother is really pleased. She said, she tells me, he's my U.S. attorney, and I'm really pleased with him. And Dan, taking the hook in his mouth, said, oh, really? What side of the city does your mother live in? And he said, well, she lives in Arizona, but you're on television so much, she thinks you're the U.S. attorney, her U.S. attorney. While he was, in fact, U.S. Attorney himself. So
I take it you don't know that I defended the Tylenol case.
No, I did not.
Yes, I did.
I did not.
Yeah, James Lewis. I was trying a case in Danville, Illinois. Because I'd been Mrs. Lewis's family had contacted me months earlier to try to get her to turn herself in. And she had not done that. And her husband was arrested. James Lewis was arrested in the New York Public Library in New York. And once he was arrested, his picture was everywhere on the news. And so she was afraid to go home. So she was walking up and down the streets of New York. And whenever she went by any appliance store that had pictures of televisions in it, all the televisions had her husband's picture on it and her picture. Because she was being sought. She was the most wanted woman in New York. So I called a friend of mine in New York who was at a fancy restaurant in New York, and I finally reached him, and I said, Ira, could you please help me pick up the most wanted woman in America and bring her to Chicago? And he said, Michael, do you know how hard it is to get reservations at the Palm? Which was the restaurant he was at. So we arranged to pick her up. I gave her a password. She said the password. He picked her up, took her to a hotel. My partner at the time, because I was in Danville, my partner at the time flew to New York and spent the night at the hotel to protect her. And then the next day I called a friend of mine in Philadelphia, who was the U.S. second in charge of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia. And I said, Leanne Lewis is going to be coming to Philadelphia. Don't arrest her. I'm going to bring her to Chicago, and she'll be processed in Chicago. But don't arrest her. Don't interview, because I didn't want her interviewed. And sure enough, I had friends in New York who drove her from New York, because I was afraid to go to the airports in New York.
Mm.
So they drove her to the airport in Philadelphia, put her on the airplane, and took her to Chicago. At that time, I was in Danville, and I flew up to Chicago to meet her in Chicago, and the media was, as you correctly point out, was going crazy about the case.
Oh, yeah.
And that was an interesting case.
Was she convicted?
She was acquitted. No, she was never charged.
Okay.
Won her acquittal by making sure she was never charged. He got convicted, and he's out of jail now. He's living, I don't know where he lives, but that was an interesting case.
What's your most interesting case that you've done?
Well, I'm only going to say one that I won. I only like to talk about cases that I've won. And
don't we all?
I would say the case in New York where, although there was a case in Boston, not in 2004, there was a case in Boston. It was a Medicare fraud investigation. And my client was in charge of sales for a large company. It was a TAP Pharmaceutical, and they had a product that was able to help men with prostate cancer, and it was sort of a chemical castration. Mm. That's what this drug did, and that was a benefit to men who had prostate cancer, because testosterone flames the cancer. And so that case was about 2 months old, and 2 months of a trial, and there were 11 defendants when we started the case. And I told the jury, I said, look at these people, because the people were all very nice-looking people, in part for two reasons. One, they were nice people, but two, the fellow that ran the company wanted to hire attractive women to be the salespersons, because most urologists are men. And so that's the other reason they were good looking, because he wanted to have attractive women as the salespeople. In any event, and attractive men. And so we tried that case, and I did a very good job of cross-examining the star FBI agent in my part of that case. And when the government rested, I said to them, I called them, I said, do you want me to argue this case? Because I'd done a pretty good job. And they said, no. And so the next day, they dismissed the case against my client before the closing argument. And that was sort of melancholy, because the other defendants wanted me to give an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt bad having to leave and not give the argument, but once the judge says the case dismissed, I had to leave.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't. You just don't.
One of the things that I've learned, and really frustrating, had a recent case in Flint, and one of the problems is that you want to say to the whole world what a horrible thing has been done by this massive waste of money. Okay, the case itself. But you can't, because you got one client that is your primary responsibility. And in that primary responsibility, everything else steps aside. You do not make your reputation on putting your client in peril by mouthing off, unless it's related to representing them. I think that's the important thing.
Yeah, I think that's very true, John, and I think that's something you have to learn when you defend people,
mm-hmm.
that you have to learn that the cases, you're not defending the whole world, you're just defending
exactly
one person.
That's exactly right.
I remember trying a case in Kansas City where the judge was very hostile to me. I remember when he read it was a case involving, it was a criminal antitrust case, and he read the antitrust indictment. I represented a fellow who was in charge of sales for a company that was involved in waste disposal of waste at hospitals and so forth. And so I defended the case, and the judge was a chief judge in the federal court in the Kansas side of the Missouri. Anyway, he was very hostile. So he starts to read literally reading the indictment to the jury as a dramatic reading.
Oh, dear.
And then the defendants knowingly and willfully violated and committed a fraud. Excuse me, judge, can we have a sidebar? Judge, do you have to read it in such a dramatic way? Sit down, Mr. Monaco.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was another. And so during that case, two interesting things happened. One, the government the prosecutors were from Washington, D.C., and I didn't want the judge to tell the jury that I was from Chicago, so they thought I was just local. But the government, they kept on saying we're from Washington, and I thought that's not helping them.
No.
And then during the case, at one point, I stood up to make an objection. I wanted to be heard. Is what my may I say what my objection is? No, sit down, judge. I'm going to have to say sit down, and I wouldn't sit down. And he had somebody remove me from the courtroom. And I go, well, I'm going to have to say something because I had to make a record of what my objection was. But that was 28 counts, and when the jury read 28 not guilties. That was a good day.
That was a
good day, yeah.
And dealing with a judge who is out to get you.
Very hostile.
Oh, out to get you. And
and you know the irony of that judge? I suppose it's not. It's sad. Apparently, his wife was ill, became very ill much years later, and he killed her.
Oh, no.
And then killed himself.
Oh.
And I thought, this is the guy that was so hostile to me.
Yeah.
And he was a very sad case, but it was he was a very difficult fellow.
Yeah. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Mike Monaco, who is an attorney, obviously, from what you've heard, high visibility cases. He's a person who deals with public issues and public people and gives his best to give their defense. He is a member of the firm of Monaco and Spivak, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Mike Monaco, who is a member of the firm of Monaco and Spivak in the city of Chicago, but he's an attorney par excellence all around the country, defending clients, representing people and issues in the courts of the states and the federal government. This is John Smetanka. Mike, you've talked about, we could go on all day, and I'm sure that you could take five shows and talk about the various interesting things that have happened in your life. But there's one thing about lawyers who are good, and I mean the best lawyers, are also the ones who give back to the profession and to the next generation. And there's something that you've been involved in and recognized as an awardee, as I recall, of, and that is what was called the Inns of Court. And it's based on the British system of how lawyers, barristers, trial lawyers, are trained and continue and are disciplined in London and around the United Kingdom. But we've adopted that. And it's a way, I want you to tell about that program because it's so important for giving back to the profession.
Sure. So about 30 years ago, one of the chief justice of the United States Supreme Court recommended that we begin, in America, we begin this system of the Inns of Court. And the idea is that there are masters of the bench who are folks who have been like 20 years in practice, barristers who are less experience, and then pupils who are young lawyers. And the idea is that you teach young lawyers not only how to try cases, but also what the rules are with respect to civility and how you prepare yourself to be a lawyer and how you defend a client. And it's a very worthwhile organization. We have had a lot of success in Chicago. We have as you mentioned, Webb and Veloukis and Fainer and Montana. All the great lawyers are in our group in Chicago, and it's a very worthwhile group.
Well, you know, it's the Inns of Court is based on this British concept. There are four Inns of Court. They are deep hundreds of years of history, each one of them, Gray's Inn, Lincoln's Inn, Middle Temple, and Inner Temple. And they are the law schools, they are the training facilities, they are the disciplinary body, and also they're the social body. And this concept of teaching people at the next generation, and frankly teaching yourselves, reminding yourselves that civility, for example, is equally important to learning how to cross-examine somebody or to do a direct examination.
Yeah, that's exactly right, John. That's very important.
And so I studied in London. I studied to be a barrister for a while in the Middle Temple. And when I came back, I tried to get, this was back in 73, just after Berger made the push for Inns of Court.
That's right,
concept.
Chief Justice Berger.
And I, unfortunately, I couldn't catch the attention of my local judges. They wanted to go a different direction in teaching young people. And they did a good program. But I regret that it took years for the Inns of Court program to get going in my area. But around the country, it's a powerful teaching program.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful program. Yeah, it's a great program. And it also helps because we have prosecutors, we have defense lawyers, we have judges, we have all kinds of folks who come to the meetings and who speak, and we get along. And that's part of what it's all about, getting along.
And now I'm going to come back to you, and you were a prosecutor. You now are in defense. You certainly deal with very competent prosecutors in the federal system, and maybe some are not so competent.
And the state system, too.
And the state system.
There are many of state court judges in as well.
And what you are working in this, you're swimming in this fish, the fishbowl, you're swimming in this ocean with people that are pretty competent, just like you are. And you have an obligation to defend somebody. You may have run across, and I certainly have, in some cases where prosecutors go completely wacko in trying to brutalize the reputation of somebody who is being charged, going way beyond the canons of ethics and what they're supposed to say. And you've got to deal with that person. How do you do that? Have you ever had that situation?
I have.
Yes.
I have, and it's very difficult to deal with that situation. And that's one thing about the law. Even Chicago, it's a relatively small group of people who do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yesterday, for example, I'm involved in the case with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So they called me up and said, "Mr. Monaco, one thing, you know, we have an accountant on this case, and turns out that you once represented him."
Ooh.
I said, well, that's, I'm sure that's not a conflict. He said, "No, it's not a conflict, but it's a small town.
It's a small town.
It's a small town, and what that means is that if you do something that adversely affects your reputation, everybody's going to know it.
If you lie to the media or to your opposing counsel, you are dead.
No, that's exactly right. You lose your credibility, and that's really what's like. For example, if I call the U.S. Attorney's Office, like I called my friend in Philadelphia in mm-hmm. the Tylenol case, he believed me because mm-hmm. he knew me. If I call a prosecutor in Chicago and say, "Listen, my client's going to turn himself in tomorrow. You don't have to go arrest him." He will not go and arrest him. He or she will not go and arrest them. That's important, that they trust you.
That is extreme. I've had situations where that didn't happen. People didn't play according to the rules. And I say according to the rules, I mean literally the court rules on publicity, for example. But I also mean those rules which help to make the system work functionally well, and those are the informal things, like courtesy, like trusting the other, a handshake. My client will do this, my client will not do that.
Right.
That's key. If you, you know, so long as you are telling the truth to the other side, and you don't have to walk in and say, "Oh, well, let me regurgitate my client's case. I'm going to throw him on the mercy of the U.S. attorney or prosecutor to be representing your client."
Yeah,
you don't have to take. We haven't even talked about the concept of plea bargaining in this world, which sometimes people don't understand, and that is a whole different show, which unfortunately we're running out of time. But there are many parts of the system that are necessary to work smoothly. Otherwise, justice doesn't get done.
I agree, John. That's exactly right.
Well, we have been talking to Mike Monaco, as I say, defense attorney par excellence around the United States, happens to be located in Chicago and came from that area, but is literally working the courts of the United States, state and federal courts around the country. And I thank you for giving us your time.
My pleasure, John. My pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. Nice seeing you again.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Saturday, Sunday, and Thursday. And until next time, remember our motto: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.